Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from the month of April. I'm in a Beatles song mood today on the Savage Nation. Last night after two drinks. Which is weird the next day. There's a hit me last night in a car on the way home. Before the drinks. I have to say before the drinks. No, all right, turn it off. I'm not in the Beatles. But it's funny how things change, how your moods change during a day. Last night after the show, you know, I heard some Beatles music. I called up and I said, all right, tomorrow I want Sgt. Pepper's and I read the news today. Oh, boy. Play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Let's see if I like that for the minute. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I never liked the Beatles when I was young. I was one of those people who stood there in the 60s dumbfounded by it. I didn't know what the Beatles phenomenon was. The girls went crazy screaming the hair. All right, so you had to grow long hair in order to meet a girl. We all did that. No one knew why, but they worked. The girls were hysterical, so the boys grew their hair long. But no one knew why. Why would they? They were hysterical for no reason. But you look back, I never liked them. I mean, it wasn't like I didn't like them. It was nothing there for me. I don't know what it was. Why am I playing it now? Let's have regular rock and roll now on the Savage Nation. Then we'll do politics. Because it is a nice day. It's a nice. You want to play Lord Buckley? I can't say that's my cup of tea. We're going to keep trying till something works for me. Till you hit my M spot. No, turn it off. What I want you to do is keep playing my favorites till you hit my M spot. You'll hear it. I want you to try now any piece of the old rock and roll I like. I want to see if my M spot gets it. Come on, try it again. Try it again, Sam. That's closer now. Now you're getting closer. You could tell a man by the music he likes, I'll tell you that. Too slow. Well, okay, it's bump and grind of a certain era. But since the boys and girls don't dance with each other anymore, this wouldn't work. All right, break that record. Let's try another one from the age. What was the one I like with the Rock Around the... Not Rock Around the Clock. Is that Rock Around the Clock? It's very exciting, but it's a different era. I admit it, but it still triggers the M zone in the brain.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on.
I don't know, when I saw this guy do this in a movie, it really changed my life. Bill Haley and the Comets. It just shook me right out of my little green carpeted world of Utopia Park and security in Queens. There were a few things that shook me out of my slumber. If it were not for Bill Haley and a few other things, I'd be a dentist, probably dead by now. I have nothing against dentists. I know you don't. It's like a different thing. I would have taken up the accordion. I would have been a dentist, and I probably would have committed Harry Carey with the gas by the time I was 46. So I remember hearing Bill Haley in the Comets. That shook me out of my cage. It shook me up. Then I heard Elvis Presley in Stop It. There was an Elvis Presley Jailhouse Rock that moved me. I was a loner even as a kid now that I look back. I'd go to the movies alone, sit in the dark, and I liked Elvis Presley movies. Now that I think about it, he was so amazing to a kid. Yeah, I mean, this guy was like the epitome of cool. Every kid wanted to be Elvis Presley. Now, when I saw him dancing in the jail there, well, today it has different connotations, I admit, I didn't see the other overt connotations. Why in jail with the dancing with the hips? Now I see it in background. All right, so that was number two. Now that already radicalizes me, emotionally changes the course of my life. Prior to this, I was still working for the Boy Scouts, giving out get-out-the-vote cards, attending a religious school dutifully. So now I'm already put on a new road by some rock and roll. Then there's some other influences. Now along comes Nat Cannonball Adderley with jazz, which I had never heard before in my life. And the music completely, as the hippies would say, blows my mind. Remember, this is without drugs now. I couldn't believe anybody could compose music like this. I had never heard anything that was in these dimensions. The influences of the Young Savage. You'll see how I became a conservative eventually from all of this. You'd think I should wind up like a doped-up hippie working for Mayor Newsom in San Francisco. Or Acorn, running Acorn. I'm putting bombs on the police cars and getting a job in the federal government for it. No, I went the other way. It's always like a Boy Scout type inside. Now, stop that music. Now then we hear the comedy of Lenny Bruce. That comes along sooner around the same period. I'm 17 years old. And I hear this unbelievable satirist in the Village Vanguard. And I could not get enough of the guy. If you could dig it up while I'm ad-libbing.
What's the success the religion? Drama. And that cat brought that tore out. What, with a beard? Nah, don't be cuts with a, you know, Princeton suit. And it should be said that children of Israel today, we noticed and asked, and I talk to them, and they just digress and get away from religion and get cute, you know, and they start building projects. And then it gets to be no shul at all. There's been a lot of talk about, is there a God? We don't know. That's not what we're here for. We're here to build a new Jewish community center. Now, then it goes, Christ must well. What is that?
All right, so I heard him. I could not believe anybody was this good. And strangely enough, my father, who was extremely, people think he was very conservative. He was conservative as a father, which is what a father should be. But he was politically actually very liberal. People don't understand that. He used to read the New York Post, which was a left-wing paper in the time. And I think he agreed with most of it. So don't assume that my father was this rock rib conservative. He was a very deep Democrat because he came through the Depression. And at that time, it made sense to be a Democrat. Today, it's a whole different story. It doesn't pay to be anything but an independent. But let's put that. So now, I play Lenny Bruce secretly in the blonde furniture hi-fi. Remember, my mother spent money and secretly bought a hi-fi. He came home furious that she bought something new. I think in a department store for the kids to have like a stereo and L. And I'm playing Lenny Bruce. I thought he would break it because she didn't buy it used. She bought it new. He always wanted to bring home something, a bargain that was repaired, that could just as excellent. Look at a speaker and a thing like, God bless him. He was always frugal. That's how we were able to live. And I'm putting the guy down. We had a house. We had a car. We all ate. We went to college. Didn't live extravagantly. And that's how people live. That's how you're going to live again, by the way. It won't kill you to live that way. A one-car family, a one-vacation family. Not eating in restaurants 13 times a week. That's how your parents lived, and that's how you're going to live, and it's not so bad. I mean, I predate rolls of paper in the kitchen, to give you some idea. Because I remember when the paper rolls came out in the kitchen, what a waste I thought it was. It was like tragic to me. Every time, we used to use kitchen towels or rags. Made sense, right? They were recyclable. We didn't call it we didn't say it was green. We had a rag. You wipe with a sponge or egg, you wring it out, you wash it, and use it again. Then all of a sudden, like Kimberly Clark comes out with rolls of paper, and they tell you, use it in place of the rag and throw it away. So intuitively, I felt like, what? This comes from a tree. Why would you? Oh, I thought it was like the tree, the bark, and turn it into a paper towel, and you wipe up and then throw it in the garbage. I knew it was like environmentally, you know, crazy. We didn't say that then. It just made no sense. So I was born as what I am. I always had common sense. So now, after I'm playing Lenny Bruce and my father comes home, he actually says, who is that guy? He says, let me listen to that. And he starts to love Lenny Bruce, which I couldn't believe. So I finally had something that we could relate to, relate with. I didn't know that he would. Why would he like that? Because the guy was funny and talented and knew how to, you know, get inside the whole, and it was unbelievable. So now, what's the next big influence? The one that really sent me down this road was a writer. Remember, I grew up on Hemingway, who I loved, I read everything he wrote. But around the same time, it was Jack Kerouac's On the Road, Dharma Bums, etc., that changed my whole life. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from the month of April. So it's a Savage Nation. Conservative. And I'm giving you a little background on how I arrived here a long time ago. I say, well, this is Cozy Cole, by the way. Topsy Part 1. This is another song that revolutionized my... All right, well, they got the picture. So I'm getting too personal, but I'm going to keep it up because I don't want to just talk about the Arizona immigration bill because thank God it passed. And thank God that the Second Navy SEAL was found innocent. It doesn't mean that the illiberal left is going to stop. You know that they're illiberal and they'll never stop till they're thrown out. So let me go backwards. Bill Haley in the Comets, Elvis Presley, Cannonball Adderley, Lenny Bruce, Kerouac's On the Road, Dharma Bums, The Subterraneans. Each book is a step along the way of my development. Ernest Hemingway, very important. Francois Sagan's Bonjour Tristesse around age 18. Unbelievable. There's a female writer from France. There's a reason, a couple of reasons. Hello, sadness, you know, welcoming sadness, bonjour tristesse. Only the French could understand the brilliance of that title. You can't even translate it. You can say, hello, sadness? It wouldn't mean anything in English. But if you say bonjour tristesse, I read it in the original French to show you how brilliant I am. No, I had to learn French, and I did. And I had to learn Spanish, and I did. I didn't like Spanish as a language for literature. I loved French as a language for literature. It's very funny that... That was a big transition in my life. Did I tell you about the Spanish-French thing in my life? I never did. All the years you've been listening to me as an addict of the Savage Nation, I realize this is not of any interest to the regular meat and potatoes audience, but I'm in one of the moods. It's that kind of thing. It's springtime. I can smell spring in the air. Lots of boating, the barbecue, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, you'll do it once or twice, and then the summer will be over. Before you know it, it's jingle bells already, On and on, the cycle, the Buddhist wheel, around and around and around. But we do it. We're supposed to do it. Because it all goes by in a blink anyway. Wasn't it? So anyway, I'm in the mood with all of these things. I'm writing them down. Oh, what did I just say, babe? I forgot already where I took off. I'm taking Spanish, and I'm struggling with the language. I'm struggling with it. I have to read the literature. I don't like Don Quixote. I don't really understand the language that well. I don't like the accents. I don't like the tilde. There was something about the tilde in it. It was something like, it didn't match my nature. It was something in the end. Don't take this the wrong way. I just couldn't relate to it. Like languages you have to relate to. It was the N with the tilde. Nunez. I don't know what it was. It was a personal thing. I just couldn't relate to Spanish. So I go to Cunningham Park in Queens, and I spend a whole miserable day in the park depressed over it. I can't get through Spanish. Oh, I'm in college already. I don't like the language. I'm getting a D in it. I can't. There's something about it. I just can't relate to the language. I don't know what it is. And I'm at a dead end. I can't figure out what to do because I can't get through college without, you know, I think it was two languages. I don't even remember anymore. So I say, a brilliant thought. I'll switch to French. So I switched to French. I got marginal degree grades in French anyway, but I loved the literature, the French literature. That was a revolutionary change for me. And it opened me up to a certain different type of literature, by the way, than I would have gotten from college Spanish literature, which is, again, no slur on the language itself. Today, I love listening to Castilian Spanish, by the way. So that was another. Then there was Bertrand Russell, Alfred Russel Wallace, and Charles Darwin. Don't underestimate any of those. I was watching military history last night. I was shocked by something. I see, you know, I see us repeating the history of the 1930s all over again. Our enemies are building up their military. We're building down our military, tearing down our military. Our enemies are increasing the rhetoric against America, and we're going softer on them than ever before. And I said, this happened before. In England, Hitler's building up his military, building up an air force which they weren't allowed to have. Britain does nothing. And then I see that the Nazis flew a plane that crashed in Scotland, and the crew died. This was before the war. A Nazi marked plane crashed in Scotland. Do you know what the Scots did? They gave the dead Nazi airmen a full military burial with full honors, as though they were equal soldiers to the British. This is how insane Britain had become just before World War II. But there were a few people, notably Winston Churchill, who were warning the Brits that they would be decimated, overrun by the Hun, unless they too built up their military and got the boys ready for war. But they were called every name under the sun the same way we on the conservative side are called every name under the sun as we try to warn you about the gathering storm clouds. Nobody wants war. Everybody would rather have peace. Nobody wants to live in bloodshed. Everybody would rather have peace and love. But take a look at Ahmadinejad. He is now, one day he's in South America giving that maniac troops, giving him nuclear material, and we do nothing. Every day the Hitler of Iran is signaling what he's going to do the minute he gets the nuclear bomb, and we do nothing. Zero. I don't understand this. But let's set that aside, Mark Masters, who has syndicated me for over 9 years now, and we're going to be, as Harry Truman said, give him you-know-what for the next couple of years. That's our job. Our job is to be watchdogs, not to be lapdogs, Mark, and I want to thank you for giving me total and absolute freedom to do so. That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have lasted a week with another syndicator. I could never have sat down after a show and been deconstructed where they say, well, you said this, tomorrow don't say that. That's it would have been the end of it for me. I've got total freedom. I need total freedom to function. And Mark, I want to thank you again. I'm glad we're going to be working together. And I know the American people, who, particularly the millions and millions of people who listen to this show, are going to breathe a sigh of relief that we have this year to look forward to together.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of the Savage Nation.
We're talking about politics, but as I said to you last week, even though each of my days is a specialty day, all the roads go back to politics. They all come and go from politics. There's nothing more political than health and nutrition. Look what Obama did to the greatest medical system in the world. So let me read you something that I remember hearing when I was a child. He who plays his fife and eats his way will live to fife another day. Now, what does that catchy rhyme mean? He who plays his fife and eats his way will live to fife another day. Well, it means that if you eat your way, you're getting certain nutrients which are life-giving and longevity-inducing. What is whey? It's the liquid remaining after the milk has been curdled and strained and turned into cheese. There's a liquid that remains, and it's usually discarded, I believe. Now, what's in the stuff that we throw out, called whey? Well, it's rich in so many things: riboflavin, B12, magnesium, potassium, zinc, selenium. So he who plays his fife and eats his whey will live to fife another day. It's the equivalent to eating whole grains as opposed to eating white bread. It's equivalent to eating brown rice as opposed to eating white rice. You know, beriberi was rampant in Asia when they ate white rice, until they found out that all of the nutrients that were being thrown out in the husk of the rice were the nutrients required to prevent, for example, rickets. You know, that's an old thing you learned in high school, probably. I don't even know if they teach that anymore. Right now, they give you a pill instead. Everything they tell you to eat garbage, live like a lab rat and take a pill. And then if you get sick, go to the quack and get six more pills. That's all. But those of us who actually studied foods and what's in them and want to know how to protect ourselves from disease have written books about it. So I remember, for example, there's another thing that's coming back to mind from my great book, 20, 30 years ahead of its time, called The Skeptical Nutritionist. And this was about another topic. If only I could remember it. I'm a little hungover, frankly, from last night. I went to a big dinner, took the dog, and I drank a lot of vodka. I feel great, don't get me wrong. Don't say it's a hypocritical. I believe in vodka. But vodka's a health food if you don't do it every night, which I don't. So there was a subject in here that I wanted to find. Oh, I remember. It's fava bean hemolysis. I know that's not on everyone's lips. It's a disease we know nothing about. But I remember when I uncovered it, when I was writing this book, how many doctors wrote me who were ahead of their time. They said, oh my God, Savage, how did you do this? Where'd you find it? Well, I had just gotten my PhD from the University of California, and I was very just fascinated by ethnic diets. And I studied every arcane piece of literature there was, and I came up with some interesting things. And so I found this about fava beans. I've never eaten a fava bean ever since. Now, sometimes if I go in an Italian deli, you see fava beans, and they're fine if you're not, let us say, I shouldn't say allergic to them, but that's close to what I'm about to tell you. There are individuals who do not understand that they lack certain enzymes to break down the fava beans. It's called a G6PD deficiency. I know it's too technical for you, and I don't want to do it to you, but the fact is you get very sick eating fava beans. It's equivalent to acute hemolytic anemia. And you say you don't know what that is. I'm showing you what could happen when you eat certain foods that you're not aware, you're not even able to digest. For example, it's well known that Jews, most blacks, and most Asians cannot digest dairy products directly because they are deficient in the enzyme necessary to break down milk, the milk product known as lactose or milk sugar. Jews, black people, and Asians have very low amounts of lactase, so they are to avoid dairy. Did you know that? So the medical profession, instead of telling Jews, black people, and Asians, don't eat dairy, they tell them, take a pill with some lactate in it. The trick would be to avoid the dairy. Now, why would Jews, blacks, and Asians have evolved or adapted to a low dairy diets? Because there weren't high dairy diets in their traditional environs. There were just not high dairy diets. Basically, there weren't high dairy diets, so they adapted to not eating dairy, and they didn't develop the enzymes necessary to break down milk sugar. Now let's go to you. Many of you believe in raw foods because you're ignoramuses, and you think that you're an ant or a rat or some kind of animal in the plains. That's absurd. The fact is that you should eat cooked foods. You're a human being. It doesn't mean you shouldn't eat some vegetables or fruits that aren't cooked. But to think you should eat only raw foods is ludicrous. It's lunacy. It's another part of the folklore of the psychologically deficient liberal to think that raw foods are better for you. It's the equivalent of thinking that a gigantic bird will come from the sky and bring you back to paradise. But actually, I want to talk about food instead. And that is the issue of how ethnic foods are very important, both to know what to eat and what not to eat. I'm coming up with something very, very small here. It's called fava bean hemolysis. And there are people who cannot eat fava beans because they lack the correct enzyme to break down fava beans. And what happens? The urine becomes very dark or red. Shock may develop in bad cases, and death can follow. Did you know that? This condition is caused by a lack of glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. That's an enzyme that breaks down the fava bean. G6PD. You don't have G6PD if you are a Kurd, for example. There are people called the Kurds, as you all know. In the north of Iraq, there's a whole land called Kurdistan. And the Kurds have one of the highest frequencies of this disorder on record. And favism, which I just described, affects individuals with a Mediterranean phenotype. And hemolysis can occur within only a few hours of inhaling even the pollen of fava bean plants, or within 1 or 2 days of eating fresh or dried fava beans. So if you are a Kurd, don't eat fava beans. You say, well, what does it have to do with me? I'm not a Kurd. I don't know. Maybe you are the type of individual who has a Mediterranean background, and you also are deficient in G6PD, and you may have a hemolytic reaction and not even know it. You go to the hospital, you have dark urine, red urine, you have shock, and you don't know it's because you just ate a fava bean salad in an Italian deli. I'm trying to warn you that this kind of knowledge was known back in ancient times, going back to antiquity. As far back as Pythagoras in the 6th century B.C., 6th century before Christ, people were warned that eating this type of bean could yield death. And in the 5th century BC, Herodotus also mentioned favism. Now, you've forgotten it, though, because we don't know anything about food in this country, of this nature, I mean. All we know is what looks good on a plate. We have geniuses who go to cooking school with pimples on their face, and they come out, as long as they know how to drizzle olive oil on something and put strawberries and raspberries on steak, they think that they're a genius. But in this century, acute hemolytic anemia was reported in 1926 in a Panamanian plantation population. Well, I don't want to go into it because it's too complicated. Maybe you've learned something. But here is another example of the classic one man's meat is another man's poison. And we can all learn from this and remember not to put down our friends who may find some of our most magical food combinations totally repugnant. Because the abhorrence of our favorite food can often reflect a survival instinct which we must learn to respect. Did you like that? This is all from page 29 of The Skeptical Nutritionist, not in print, so I'm not selling you anything, unlike Wallbanger or those who sell floor mats at every turn. I'm giving you information for free because it's important to do. Now, what if you're not of a Kurdish background? I'm going to just read a little bit more to you. You don't want to hear any more about that. Did you know that I can tell you what they studied, Arabs with this and Jews and this and that. I don't think Christians are affected by this at all. I think they can eat anything. I get the feeling the cracker can eat most anything. And that's why they live on mayonnaise, white bread, and scotch. Good genetic stock. They don't worry about G6PD deficiency because they never eat the stuff. They wouldn't be caught dead near a fava bean. Give them a white bread sandwich with mayonnaise and a nice scotch, and that's it. They're happy as a Maasai eating the blood of an ox. I think that's funny, and so I'm making myself laugh. I sound like a nutty professor now. Remember you had professors who would tell a joke that was so arcane only he laughed at it, and you thought he was a genius because he was laughing at something and you didn't understand? I just did that because I did just say something only I understood. Savage.
I like my mama's food, it's so good to me. Her meatballs have the spice that make them taste so nice. A little wine after we dine makes you feel so doggone fine. My mama's a cooking.
All right, welcome to a Savage Nation. We're talking about a food and a nutrition. And I'm focusing today on ethnic nutrition because many of us take pride in our ethnic background, as we should. And we eat what we think are ethnic meals, but in fact, I'm sorry to tell you, most of the ethnic meals that we're eating are not ethnic meals at all. Example, case in point, Italian food is not really Italian food that the average Italian ate, let's say, 150 years ago in Italy. The Italian diet then was quite sparse. It might have been a whole grain spaghetti or a whole grain noodle on the farm with some vegetables with very little animal protein. And perhaps some cheese products because they didn't kill the animal. But literally, they didn't slaughter the animal every time they ate a meal. And what you're eating is holiday meals three times a day, and you're getting the degenerative diseases associated with overly rich diets. It's the same with almost every other ethnic group on earth. And so you'd say, Jewish food. Oh, I'm going to go to the deli and have a corned beef sandwich with a pickle. And that's not Jewish food. That is 19th century holiday Polish food. Jewish food is Yemenite food. You want to really eat Jewish food? Eat a Yemenite diet. That is the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. And what the Yemenites eat is what the ancient Israelites probably ate. And that's why some of us wind up with diabetes and heart attacks so young, because we're eating diets that we're not adapted to. Did you know this? You say, oh, come on, how do you know that? How do you know that? How do you know any of this stuff? Well, I trust my doctor. He tells me to eat what I want and just take Lipitor. And then if I get sick from any food, just take something to digest it. That's all. And if that doesn't work, they'll cut us open and remove something. All right, well, you can live that way if you want. You know what I'm saying? While the pig, the crow, the squid, and like creatures are forbidden by the Hebrew dietary laws, saturated fats, sucrose, and chemical additives are the unclean or forbidden foods in the etiology of internal health of rational man, I wrote. Page 138 of The Skeptical Nutritionist. I'm a genius. I really am. Boy, I was smart when I was young. That's really a good paragraph. Look at that one. Where the pig, the crow, the squid, and like creatures are forbidden by the Hebrew dietary laws, saturated fats, sucrose, and chemical additives are the unclean or forbidden in the etiology of internal health of rational man. That's really good stuff. And then I wrote, I support tradition, but urge my religious friends to eliminate dangerous components of their foods developed and introduced long after biblical laws were written. But it's like talking to yourself. You go to a Jewish group, they're sticking their... They're eating Stella d'Oro, a cake in their face every 2 minutes, a sweet. They wonder why they have diabetes, and they look so bad at 50, so many. I'm serious. They've lost all concept of diet. You can't live that way. It's impossible. Some can. It is true. Some people can eat anything. I call them nutritional rogues, by the way. These are the people who you say, oh, my grandfather lived to 104. You're full of crap, Savage, because he ate everything you just said he shouldn't eat, and he drank a bottle of scotch. I said, so he's a nutritional rogue. You try it. Get back to me when you're 50. See how long you last. Right? What else did I want to tell you about? I want to read your paragraph. Introduction. Why I am a skeptic. Oh, this is an interesting one. I quoted Galileo, who wrote, there is no scientific work that only one man can write. Now, that was written by Galileo in the Middle Ages. Listen to this, Al Gore, you schmuck. Al Gore, schmuck. And every other putz in the academic establishment who said that all the science is in on global warming. Schmucks, idiots. You don't even know what science means, you schmucks. Here's what Galileo wrote, putz. There is no scientific work that only one man can write, schmuck. Galileo wrote that, but Al Gore said all the science is in on global warming. And then the idiots in the media said all the science is in on global warming. They're heretics. We know the earth is flat. And anyone who says the earth is round is not a scientist, said Al Gore. And then the schmucks on MSNBC snickered and went, yeah! Introduction, why I am a skeptic. Food is such a personal thing, and how anybody can dare suggest diets for others continually shocks me. And repugnant cuisine is scarcely the road to health and long life, I wrote in 1983. One more paragraph. Let's see. Hey, oh, this is good. Now, there are fine books on becoming vegetarian. Some of my closest friends are vegetarians. That's a joke. Yet we must not seek to declare as an objective truth that the plant world holds our major key to longevity. It may be true that George Bernard Shaw, Tolstoy, Wagner, Shelley, Byron, Thoreau, and other illustrious figures were vegetable eaters, but so was Hitler. In fact, the German dictator's manic depressive mood swings and associated unexpected aggressive outbreaks might easily have been somewhat controlled with a good dose of high-quality protein and unrefined carbohydrates and with a steady intake of a good vitamin mineral supplement on a regular basis. Better, Hitler should have gnawed on a big leg of lamb once a day and had a glass of wine. The well-known photo of Hitler and Eva Braun at Berchtesgaden with the maniac passed out in an armchair after eating lunch is not an image the hypoglycemically attuned researcher is likely to forget, I wrote. Diet and behavior vary in too many people for us to look for a simple set of rules as our salvation from too intense swings of mood. So, I mean, I wrote some nice stuff. You know, Hitler was a vegetarian and didn't drink either. And he was always starving. He could never get enough of anything because he was always hungry, so he invaded one country after another and killed too many people. As I said, if he ate a leg of lamb and had a drink once in a while, the whole course of history would have been altered. It's absolutely true. The book was way ahead of its time, 1981, Macmillan Publishing, out of print. I still own the copyright, so don't rip it off. I think I'll reprint it now. A Strategy for Designing a Nutritional Program. It's a good book, not for sale. Not for sale. And I want to tell you that the word food fascism, the phrase, I think I coined it on page 6. Food fascism. I was against it then. The bookstores aligned with correct diets for the unmet masses. Social engineers, you see, I was against them. And then I wrote, food fascism, like other varieties of the social disease, requires lieutenants to proselytize. Not wishing to participate in any form of totalitarianism, I wrote, I intend not to dictate a correct diet for a fictional reader. Now, if only Michelle Obama knew that. She dictates to you what you should eat, and then she eats ice cream in Martha's Vineyard. And you're not supposed to notice that. She came back 8 pounds heavier. I mean, I'm sorry. The king has no clothes. We're living through it. Every day we see the Victory Garden that's outside the White House, and then grow your vegetables and eat good, and you're not eating right. They're going to arrest you if your child's obese, take them away from you. And every time they're on vacation, there they are in Dearborn, Michigan, and they're eating ice cream cones. What the heck? Not good for you to eat like that. Not healthy at all. You know, practice what you preach, my friend. I want to now go back to a book I wrote. It's not available. It's not for sale. I am not selling books. Unlike Wallbanger, unlike the Marjo with the blackboard, this book was written in 1981. It's called The Skeptical Nutritionist, The Way of the Skeptical Nutritionist. And Macmillan Publishing published it. It's a little-known book. I may reproduce it, actually, because it's so ahead of its time. On page 6, I talk about food fascism. Did you know that? That even when I was a nutritionist, I was already into this? Here's what I wrote. The bookstores are lined with correct diets for the unmet masses. Social engineers, having arranged our personal lives from sexual behavior to dying, have been aided in applying their golden rules to our last frontier food. Food fascism, like other varieties of the social disease, requires lieutenants to proselyte. An example of disease states that can be induced. Okay, let's start from the top. Are you worried about diabetes? Has your doctor told you it's related to diet and exercise? Or just put you on a little pill? Listen to one paragraph. An example of disease states that can be induced as a result of severe and dramatic dietary changes can be found amongst the Yemenite Jewish people. For example, the Kurds and Yemenites who came to Israel had rates of diabetes as low as the Eskimos of Iceland and Greenland, 0.3 per thousand. Soon after settling in areas where Western habits and diets prevail, a sharp rise in the prevalence of diabetes is noted.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from the month of April. A realist. I'm a realist because I live in the real world. I don't live in the ivory tower, and I don't live in the media tower of disconnect from reality. I'm a man who actually walks in the streets and talks in the streets. So I see who does the hard work. I'm not blind. I'm not a blind man. I see in every restaurant where I go who does the cooking, who does the busing, who does the waiting. I see it. Well, that's wonderful. I am a man who works very hard, way past an age when many men would be retired. I work because the work ethic was built in me. My father drummed it into me that work was a virtue. Hard work was an even greater virtue. And harder work was even a greater virtue. I don't know, that's the way I was raised. Sometimes I wonder, why do I keep working? The answer is because I have no alternative. So I keep working. Doesn't bother me. It's an ambrosia for me. Work is my ambrosia. I wouldn't know how life could be lived without work. And yet I see millions of bums in America who have never worked a day in their life. Over here where I live, and I live in several different places, by the way, around the country and in this particular area of San Francisco, I see they build housing, for Section 8 housing, primarily for illegal immigrants and gangbangers. They wanted to make sure that the white people of the area had diversity, so they brought them in. And every day I see an illegal immigrant in a wheelchair being pushed around by his wife, smiling as they go. I ask myself, are they kidding me? Are they kidding me? How in the world did they land on Easy Street? How did they land on Easy Street? That an illegal immigrant could wind up collecting free care from the United States of America, laughing all the way to the bank. But that's just one example of the other side of the story. The big question is, could America survive without the immigrant labor force? As you well know, the Republicrats say no. As you well know, the bloated frauds like Newt Gingrich and Karl Rove will tell you that this law is bad. As you well know, fraudulent fake Republicans like Newt Gingrich and Karl Rove are already taking the other side, showing their true colors, which is not red, white, and blue, but red alone. And so the fact of the matter is we have to get down to brass tacks. Who would do these jobs if the immigrants were to repatriate themselves? If they said, you know what, I can't stay in America anymore because they're cracking down on illegal immigration. I don't want to be arrested. It's been fun while it lasted. I have to leave. And they all started, they wouldn't all leave, but let us say 20% of the 30 million started to leave the country. What would happen? Who would take the jobs? Who would do the gardening? Who would do the cooking? Who would do the cleaning? Who would work in the slaughterhouses? The answer is people, able-bodied people on welfare. And then you say, well, what are you talking about? They don't know how to work anymore. Well, they'll learn how to work. Work is something that has to be learned. It is not in the nature of man, by the way, to work. Children are fundamentally lazy and good for nothing unless you teach them to work. They're lazy and good for nothing. They'd rather sit around and they'd rather watch television and eat a free meal and then have you give them an allowance so they can go out and buy some drugs and go to a nightclub until they're 36 years old when Obama finally takes them off health care and they're no longer a child. At 26 years of age, maybe they'll expand it to 36. They can stay home with a hairnet and you know, you both can do your hair together and your nails. The fact of the matter is a child needs to be taught to work. A child is a formless lump of clay. Children are basically lazy and no good. You have to turn them into a worker. And that has to be done from childhood. So what do you do immediately? Let's forget the pie in the sky, Plato's Republic, reorganizing society. Let's talk about immediately. Let's say 20% of the labor force, which is illegal, goes back home. And suddenly you have jobs begging in hotel chains to make the beds. I know who makes the beds. Hardworking Guatemalan and Mexican women. I look at them. I speak with these people. I'm not immune. I can guarantee you I leave bigger tips than the liberals do. I can guarantee you, incidentally. I can guarantee you that the libs, the big mouths, don't give them 10 cents. I can guarantee you I do. So on a personal level, I know what I'm talking about. I have sympathy for hardworking people. But who would take the job is the issue, not whether I tip and you don't. The issue is who would take the job. Are you telling me that the Britney Spears look-alike girls from the suburbs are going to go and make the beds? Are you telling me that the girls from the suburbs are going to go and do menial jobs like becoming a busboy or a busgirl? I'm saying yes, they will have to. As the economy gets worse and worse, as the government finally acknowledges they're just printing money and there is no money, yes, they're going to work again. They're going to learn how to work. Maybe they'll drop a few trays in the beginning, but eventually the girls will learn to work again. The boys will learn how to work again. And then we will open thousands of trade schools across America. You put me in charge of this, I can guarantee you I could straighten this country out in less than 4 years. I would take hundreds of millions of dollars that is being wasted on Nancy Pelosi's road projects, and I would open up trade schools across America. And I said trade. Don't tell me everyone's ready for college and they all need a computer. Take a look at what's in college today. Go take a look at what goes on in your colleges. Everyone's a college boy. Take a look with the pants hanging under their behinds. That's a college boy marching around. The idiots, they're stupid when they come in. They're stupider when they go out. They want to take a job right away. They're not equipped for anything. They never should have been in college to begin with, 90% of them. Send them to trade school. See if they can even do that. That's not easy to learn how to turn a screwdriver or to cut a piece of wood straight. Go see how hard that is to learn how to be a plumber or an electrician or a carpenter or an auto mechanic. We need millions of people retrained to do actual jobs. And it could be done right here in this country. How is it that the Mexican people can train their men to be good tradesmen? Where did they learn to do this? How did so many Mexicans, for example, learn to do these things? The answer is they learned in their home country, which has a better trade school system than we do. And that is because we have been under the delusion for many years that everyone is a college boy, a white-collar web designer, or God knows what he's going to be, a CEO or a web designer. Come on, create a website. Well, the fact is he has to learn how to fix a carburetor. Maybe he ought to learn how to put a brake into a car. Maybe he ought to learn how to attach a muffler underneath the carriage of a car. And then we could become self-sufficient again from the point of view of labor. But that's skilled labor, my friends. Trade schools are not unskilled labor. That is skilled labor, and we can certainly train an entire generation in less than a year. We train men during, before World War II, how to fly airplanes in a year. We train 17-year-old boys how to fly Mustangs in less than a year. We train them how to drive tanks in less than a year. Don't tell me we can't train a generation how to turn a screwdriver in less than a year. No, it's a matter of whether we have the vision to do it, and we have the leadership to do it, and whether we have the will to do it. The answer is I have it, do you? So that's that. Talk Radio Network, which is an independent syndicator. I have no pressures. I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do, where they have to answer to a lower authority. I flew across the country in a friend's plane. I land in Oakland, California at a private jet port. 6 hours later, my poor dog, Teddy, the 11-pound poodle, was such a good boy, he didn't pee on the plane. He never does. Amazing. He knows not to. It's like special for him. Oh, I have certain techniques as well of not feeding him a certain amount, and blah, blah, blah. I don't give him too much water. Like, common sense. We get off the plane. We run across the tarmac, and one of the ground crew runs with me. Now, listen to this. He's a blue-collar guy, regular guy with a billet, you know, a hat on, baseball. And the dog starts to relieve himself against the bush, and we're talking, and we're talking, and we're talking, and the dog's leg doesn't come down. I look at him. He looks at me, and still going. I said to him, this looks like a guy who was in a bar all night, and I never saw a dog of any size relieve himself for that length of time. Almost a Ripley's Believe It or Not, how much he kept in. I don't know where the water came from. That's the funny part of the story. I look over to the right of the runway. I see a monster airplane, a DC-9, an old, monstrous DC-9. But there was something odd about the DC-9. There were 4 to 6 guys in black with black hoods with pump shotguns around the airplane. So I said to the ground guy, I said, is that plane for the Oakland Raiders? Are they coming in or are they leaving town? Why do they need guys with shotguns on it? He said, no, Michael. He says, that plane isn't filled with the Oakland Raiders. I said, who's on it? Well, you'll hear the minute I come back on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from the month of April. Talk Radio Network, which is an independent syndicator. I have no pressures. I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do, where they have to answer to a lower authority. Oh, I forgot to tell you the rest of that story. First rule of radio is when you promise something, you better deliver. So anyway, to get back to Teddy peeing on the bush for a couple of minutes, which would have made any bar hound would have been proud of the little guy. He was up to any Irish bar hound. I noticed I didn't say Irishman, I said any Irish bar hound. He stood there on and on and on. So I look over, I see this monster DC-9, and I see the guys with the black and hoods and masks and pump shotguns. I said, who's on it? You know, the sports team on the private? No, he said, those are illegal aliens being flown back to Mexico by the U.S. Marshals Service. I said, oh, my God, they're actually flying illegal aliens out of America? I said, how often does this happen? He's, oh, Michael, he said, we have these flights, regular flights, 3 a week. He said, we call it here. We on the ground call this Adios Airways. So I said, great. And I said, well, they come back the next day, they walk right back. He says, it's even worse than that. He said, with one hand, the government spends a fortune. The marshals do their job. They fly them out of the Bay Area, and they can't even take them to Mexico. They deposit them in San Diego, right near the border, and they come right back. Can you believe what this country has become? How schizophrenic and insane it is?
Play some rock and roll.
Just having a good time. You think I'm going to eat my heart out over this, you're mistaken. If I have an illegitimate government, what do you want me to do about it? When you have lawmakers siding with lawbreakers, what do you want me to do about it? I'm only a talk show host. It's your fault. You elected the lawbreakers, not me. We are talking about
the illegitimate who are grinding the country down. All right, thanks, Frankie. Give him a few whatever, and we'll see him in the you-know-where. So the illegitimate liberals are screaming bloody murder, saying Nazi and fascist, because the illegals are being asked to show their ID. Let me ask all of you good liberals something. Have you recently tried not showing your ID when you board an airplane? Have you good libs tried not showing your ID when a cop stopped you for having a taillight out? Have you good libs gone to a grocery store and written a check recently and be asked for your ID? Have you said, I won't do it because you're a Nazi? I know all of you idiots believe that anybody asking for identification of a illegal immigrant is a fascist, but how come it doesn't apply to you, you morons? I think that I'm the elder statesman of conservative talk radio. I actually didn't believe it, but I've reached that point. I'm giving myself a title. I know that I'm a national phenomenon in many ways, but I am the elder statesman. Most of the guys are 20 years younger than me, which is fine. And some of them are good, but most of them don't even understand what this country has come from. They kind of read about it, but as much as I hate to admit it in a way, I've lived through it. From Eisenhower to Obama in two generations. From Ben Casey to Nurse Jackie in two generations. From mutual assured destruction to assured national destruction, two generations. From Evan Rude to Always Rude in two generations. From John Wayne to Lady Gaga in two generations. From I Spy to I Cry in two generations. From I Love Lucy to I Love Loosely in two generations. From Al Einstein to Al Gore in two generations. From I Have a Dream to I Have a Scheme in two generations. From Catcher in the Rye to Ketchup on the Fly in two generations. Starlets to harlots. Preachers to breachers. Athletes to sexleets. Rabbis to sandflies. Boy Scouts to Toy Scouts. Girl Scouts to Twirl Scouts. From the Eagle to the Beagle in two generations. From LSD to ADD. From cardigans to partykins. From Cub Scouts to Scouting Cubs. From aspirin to OxyContin. From Lady Jane to Let's Get Insane. From science to lie-ince. From law to claw. From zip guns to machine guns. From Manhattans to Cosmos. From Red Book to Spread Books. From acorn the tree to acorn the spree. From babies to puppies. From guppies to yuppies. From private vets to private jets. From soldiers who kill to soldiers without will. From lassie to sassy. From religion to pigeons. From eons to peons. From rapists to offenders. From stickball to speedballs. From Gallo to Lafitte. From Matusse to Chartreuse. From Milltown to Prozac. From the Air Force to a Bear Force. From the Navy to Loose Gravy. From the Army to I'm Swami. From Israel to Fizreal. From Taiwan to Spizwan. From the Dragon and the Eagle to the Dragon and the Beagle. From Dragsters to Drag Queens. From Redwoods to Deadwoods. From Health Foods to Wealth Foods. From Heroes to Zeros. From UFOs to IOUs. From Hirsute to Lawsuit. From Melarolls to Melanine. From Niagara to Viagra. From Coney Island to Survival Island. From the Five Families to the Sly Families. From Al Capone to Sly Stallone. From Ike to Spikes. Truman to Untruman. Truman to Untruman. From Truman to the Untruman. From Reagan to Swayman. Rayburn to Pelosi. From the Eagle to the Beagle. From the Bible to the Legal. That's the story of America the Great to America that Greats. We're going to take a break now. We're going to take another set. A few more minutes, we'll be back to pick up the old horn right here on the Savage Nation.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
I almost feel like now moving away completely from the politics of the day and almost going into the bars I drank in. The people I ran into, how I feel a little hungover today. I always do very good shows when I have a slight hangover. Not a very severe hangover, but a mild hangover is very, very good for radio, I find. And I've always found it to be very good for radio. I don't know what it is. Let's see, what did I do? So as the curtain of night descended upon the Savage Nation's host, yours truly, Michael Savage, I wandered up to the district known as North Beach in San Francisco, the more or less still Italian district of the city. Actually, I didn't go directly there. I walked up California. I have a certain walk I like, which I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't want to be, let us say, accosted on the way. But I walked through Chinatown on the way to North Beach because I love Chinatown. The reason I love to walk down Grant Avenue at night is because it gives me hope to see the small merchants closing their stores at night, raising their gates, securing their wares. It reminds me of my father's little store down in New York on Ludlow Street, how they would close the gates at night and lock it up and look with a love at the merchandise that fed their family. Now, you don't see much of this anymore in America. Most of us are so removed from merchandise and being a shopkeeper. But in essence, the small businessman, the small businesswoman, is the core of the capitalist system and always has been and probably always will be, despite the dominance of the great corporations. The small businessman is the key to the survival of a capitalist nation. Anyway, to make a long story short, I also like to see the Chinese people. I like hearing, as I walk down the avenue, the young men, the vigorous young men practicing martial arts in the upstairs studios, either through the drums are also part of the martial arts. I hear them practicing Taekwondo in some of the studios. I mean, I hear everything. I'm like Vincent the Blind Man, if you want to know the truth, because as I walk, although my eyes are open, so are my ears, and I have very sharp ears, and I listen to the sounds of the street. I don't have to know one word of Mandarin to understand what's going on. And I say to myself, you know, this gives me hope. And the reason it gives me hope is because I know that the Islamo-fascists will never conquer the Chinese, not in China nor in America. I said, are you kidding me? You're telling me these Tongs are going to let the Islamo-fascists dominate their neighborhood? Never in a million years. They disappear without you even knowing what happened. And there are so many other ethnic enclaves in this country that will never fall under the sway of the sword. That's all I can tell you. They have faced the conqueror in the past, and they have driven the conqueror out. Of course, there are, if you want to get into the history of China and its conquest, and it was conquered by the Muslims at a certain point, but I won't go into that because you don't know that half of China is Muslim and a good half of China was Muslim as a result of conquest. But in the United States of America, I can tell you right now, they don't even know this is going on. These people live in their own world, and it's kind of nice to step into a world that is separated from my world. So I walked through Chinatown, as I said, smelling the garbage in the street, and walked across Broadway, you step across Broadway, now you're suddenly stepping into the garlic world, the world of garlic and jazz, so to speak, and you're into the Italian district. And for some reason, I went to a place that I haven't been for years. I used to hang out there a lot. It's an Irish bar. And I looked for my friend because I hadn't seen him in years. I stopped hanging out up there a number of years ago. And I went into O'Reilly's Tavern, and there was Miles, an old friend of mine running an Irish tavern. And we talked. I said, how's your son? He's 10 years old. And I haven't seen him in 5 years or more. I remember when he was a little boy in the bar. And I said, you know, I still remember your Irish, what was he, an Irish, what do they call those, giant dogs? Help me out. I forget. And you know those big dogs, whatever they're called, the Irish something or other. No, not an Irish setter. They're gigantic. They're hounds. They're giant. He had a dog, Fionn. They only lived to six. I love this dog. I watched him grow up in the bar. This dog was so big that he, like a foot, was as bigger than my dog Teddy's entire body. And one of the most beautiful dogs in the world. But he died at six. So I said, you know, Miles, I remember your first dog, Fionn. He says, oh, I had a second. And he died too. He says, now I have a third, just a wee puppy. He still got the Irish whatever. I'm sorry I don't remember the name of the dog. I'm feeling kind of silly right now. I can't. But, you know, it was nice going in there. But on the way in, two guys offered to buy me a drink, and I never accept a drink from a stranger. I'm just that kind of girl. So I didn't accept a drink from the strangers. But we got to talk. It turns out that they're sheriff's deputies from another county in California who just happened to hear my voice and say, I can't believe our luck, and we talked. And we talked about the fact that white men are being driven out of every sheriff's department, out of the highway patrol, and every police department in the state of California, being replaced by lesbians, being replaced by primarily Mexicans, being replaced by anyone but a white male. Shall I tell you the story of Love by the Sewer Plant? In order to do that, I have to set this up. Play the Shabub Shabub song. I Only Have Eyes for You. I want to go back in time now. And I hope that the girl involved is not listening. I pray to God.
I can't see anyone but
you. We're talking Springland, New York. Not Springland. We're talking, I don't know the town anymore. We're talking Route 42. We're talking 56, 57. We're talking a sewer plant. We're talking about Love by the Sewer Plant. First Love by the Sewer Plant. Now, this girl was so beautiful that the, like, it was like summer stock. Turn that on. They can't listen to me in the music. They got the mood already. We said it. In other words, this was a small hotel, like, you know, nothing fancy. The owner was a former boxer, a pugilist. He was the one where I told you that Jackie, who worked at the hotel, got thrown in the pool. I don't remember the name of the hotel. But he was a tough guy, this guy, genuinely tough guy. And that if he got into an argument with anyone who worked for me, beat them up and threw them off the property, that type. Everyone was terrified of him. Old school, New York Jewish kind of street fighter type. So he ruled this little hotel that he had like with an iron thumb, an iron whatever, iron boot. He was a tough guy, and the things ran right. Nothing ever went wrong. No one robbed cutlery. No one talked back. So anyway, I'm a kid. There's a kid there, and boom, it's Love by the Sewer Plant across down the thing in the river by the Neversink River. The water was so cold that when you waded across it, your feet turned blue. I'll tell Love by the Sewer Plant, but starting with the Shabub Shabub again. Now I got time to tell it. Again, they can't find it.
Again, my love must be a kind of blind.
This is unbelievable. I lost my desire to talk already.
I can't see anyone but
on the
you.
Uptake, they're not. I got a migraine. Just clicked in. Whole right side of the head is out. They don't understand this. How could the audience follow my brain? I got to make them follow. How? Explain to them. All right. Okay, turn it off now. It's 56, 57, Plymouth Fury, 59, 59. My uncle had a Plymouth Fury, I think. I'm not sure. Somewhere around then. Outside one of the hotels in the Catskill Mountains. I'm still young, 15. I don't know how old I was, something like that. So, fall in love, first love by the sewer plant. Here's how it is. This girl was so stunningly gorgeous, like just really beautiful, that the theater companies would come through. They had like an entertainment in these hotels, like they call it a casino. At night, they'd have entertainment. Sometimes they'd have a comedian who was terrible, a juggler, a balloon man, who then eventually the father of the guy who went on XM or Sirius. His father was a balloon man, allegedly, who went around making pornographic images with balloons, as the son does verbally. Things like that. In other words, schlocky entertainment. So, nevertheless, they thought they were artists. You got to understand that. Even though they were schlocky entertainment, let's say they could paint in velvet paintings, they're still a painter. In their mind, they're Van Gogh. They were theatrical, and everyone else was bourgeois, you know. The other people ate the borscht, and they ate the chave. In other words, they were the artistes, so they understood. So, in other words, some of these entertainers came around, and they looked at this girl, and they came running up. I was holding her hand or walking with her. We were kids. And they said, Manny, I wanted you to see this girl. This is the girl I was telling you about. And they, like, looked at her like she was a specimen of, you know, like, biblical beauty. So to make a long story short, it's just Young Love by the Sewer Plant. And what I meant was, where are you going to go when you're a kid? You got nowhere to go. So we took a walk down the hill, down the hill, down the hill, down the hill, down the hill. Jack and Jill went down the hill. And it was a long slope down to the Neversink River. And there was a sewer treatment plant, which occasionally, as you well know, with sewer treatment plants, they're not exactly, they don't smell that good. But kids don't care. They can override anything, particularly when the lust hits them. So the two kids walk down the hill, they cross the river, and their feet, they roll up the dungarees, take off the shoes, the legs are blue. And they have a little moment of passion together. And it was his first moment of passion. It was not exactly on the level of a complete moment of passion, but for him, it was the first of that type. So now the kid is starstruck. Walked like stars in his eyes after that. There were not enough stars in the sky that night, in the black sky and the billions of stars, to equal the passion that he had for the world, where he thought he could literally reach out, grab a star, and fly away. That's how phenomenal he felt as a youngster. But then, of course, as you well know, nothing like that lasts. So what I'm getting at with the story is that it was by a sewer plant, and there's nothing more to it, and boom, and now play some John Coltrane, because there's no more to the story that I care to tell, because if I do, it'll become a pantomime, and I don't want to embarrass myself with a pantomime of something that was quite beautiful. So why don't you play some John Coltrane so they'll understand why it ended that way. Anyway, it just ends abruptly. Good jazz ends abruptly. Savage. The reason the rich support Obama is because they think that they can control him and bring about a shrinking of the middle class and a new Soviet America, where there will be the ruling class and the peasants, of which they will be the ruling class, and he will be continue to be their friend, colleague, and puppet. What they don't understand is that Obama's smarter than they are, much like a certain Austrian was originally used by the Krupp Steel Corporation and other large manufacturers in Germany who thought that they could manipulate this charismatic young man who was running around Germany raising so much interest in politics, and they thought that they could put him in power, this young man from Austria, and eventually manipulate him. Little did they know that he was using them. They weren't using him. I have studied Hitler's rise from the time he was a mere corporal in World War I, and somewhat of a war hero, by the way, and how when the National Socialists first emerged on the scene in Germany, which, remember, was a democracy during the Weimar Republic, how he was in bed with all the industrialists. The rich of the country loved him. The rich liked what they were hearing. The rich loved it. You didn't know that Hitler was a back-to-nature man, did you? Many of you don't even know. You're so ignorant of history, I can't blame you. I blame the education system. He was a vegetarian. He didn't drink. He was a back-to-nature movement guy. But more than that, he was anti-capitalist, so they thought. The socialists who were aligned with Hitler, the National Socialists, were against private property and ownership, but Hitler didn't go for that right away. As a matter of fact, it led to a big fight within the Nazi Party itself. Soon after Hitler aggrandized a great deal of power to himself and established his dictatorship, his original thugs, his supporters, the brown shirts, and the Ernst Röhm, the street fighter, and he had a big fight because Ernst Röhm was a diehard socialist. And they fought. And he said to Hitler, how could you be doing business with all these capitalists when we are supposed to be such pure socialists? But Hitler was far smarter than Ernst Röhm. He knew that he continued to need the big capitalists to advance the Nazi agenda. And so he never outright attacked the big capitalists. He worked with them. So Ernst Röhm and the other diehard socialists in the SA, the brown shirts, rebelled. As a result, they were exterminated in the Night of the Long Knives, which you should study one day. When Hitler's SS lay in wait for the SA, who were in a male bacchanalia on a certain lake in Germany with each other. The SA, as you see, were oriented in that direction. Study it, it's historical. And the SA leadership were having fun with their boyfriends on a certain lake in Bavaria. The SS lay in wait for them, killed most of them, arrested some of the others, including Ernst Röhm, who was later executed. It's a fact of history. I'm not embroidering. I'm not inventing. I'm giving you a fact of history. What does it have to do with Obama? Everything and nothing. Everything, because it's quite telling to study how Hitler rose to power using, although he said he was a socialist, he used the capitalists to get to power. okay? And his socialist buddies were very mad at him because he didn't impose his socialism fast enough, so he had them killed. But then, of course, after he had total power, there was another story, which we're not going to have to give you a whole history lesson right now. And I don't really cover this in my book. I touch on it, but it's irrelevant. What's relevant to this discussion is Obama's Marxist socialist roots and why I define him as not a socialist. That's baby talk. You've heard the word, hey, Obama's a socialist. It doesn't mean anything anymore. When I was talking about socialism radio 10 years ago, nobody had used the word in talk radio that I know of. Nobody had used it. They didn't even know what the word meant. Then all of a sudden, they were all, oh, socialist, socialist, schmocialist. Well, there are quite a number of varieties of socialist. You have to define what you're talking about. This nation has been somewhat socialist since the 1960s. Okay? So what variety of it? How virulent is this socialism? I define Obama as a pan-Leninist. That's something you haven't heard about. The golfer doesn't know what the word means. If you say pan-Leninist to the golfer, he'd have to look it up because he hasn't seen it anywhere. If you said it to a wall banger, he would get embarrassed and angry and fire somebody. If you said it to the leprechaun, he propped the words pan-Leninist, the phrase pan-Leninist to understand it. And then you'll understand Obama when he says, we didn't do this just to elect a man. So I want you to play that whole soundbite now, and you'll understand what I mean when I say pan-Leninist if you listen to that soundbite again.
If you are out there knocking on doors and making phone calls, talking to your friends and neighbors, if you do not give up hope, then I guarantee you that not only are we going to win this election, because this was never just about putting a president in the White House. It was about building a movement for change that lasted for a long time. We will build
building a movement for change that lasts a long time. Now, does that definitively prove he's a pan-Leninist? Of course not. But he certainly gives away an intimation of what I am talking about. And the rest you have to, study to get to the bottom of it. So when you look at the adulation of one-third of the population that gave Hitler the power in Germany, and you hear what I just said? The adulation of one-third of the population that brought Hitler to power, and you look at the adulation of the one-third of the American population that brought Obama to power, you say, well, all right, that doesn't prove anything either, does it? You got to understand that most Germans did not even go along with the crude imagery of the early Nazi party. They didn't even like the anti-Semitism of the early Nazi movement at all. Most Germans were quite polite. They did not go along with the crude images that Hitler was putting out there. Nor were they likely to become involved in or approve of physical violence directed at individual Jews and their property. Did you understand any of this? It was a very small fringe in the Nazi movement that was anti-Semitic to this degree. Many of you don't understand how the leftist thinks of the radical university Lexist. Most of them are maniacs. You think you hear electric cars, you hear Obamacare. These are just minor details to them. They would like to have a complete and total socialist revolution in America, where masses of people were taken out, put into re-education camps, worked to death, and then executed. Along the lines of the Red Brigades in Cambodia, or the Red Communist Chinese in China. This is very serious business that we're talking about. You got to understand this. The misery that is felt by society today is directly related to the pacifism that is rampant in our military today. The internationalism that is rampant in our political class today. And the rot that is set in Washington.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
America's most exciting radio talk show,
the Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from the month of April. Don't worry, it's the Savage Nation. Just listen. Somewhere, you'll see.
Ce soir à ma table, il fait si froid dehors. Ici c'est confortable, laissez-vous faire, Milord. Et prenez bien vos aises, vos peines sur mon cœur, et vos pieds sur une chaise.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
We're playing on the Savage Nation. Watch where I'm going.
To shine like you've had too much wine. That's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling, and you'll sing Vita Bella.
All right, so Chinese to Edith Piaf to Dino, right? And here I am. So I'm in one of these moods. I have no idea how to define it. I'm indifferent. I've arrived at the station called indifference. I have defined Obama as a Marxist-Leninist. I've done so as well as I can do, other than in the book that I'm writing. You're going to see what comes out of that one. But at this point, to spend every waking moment of this radio show defining Obama as the Marxist-Leninist thug that he is, the anti-American, anti-democratic, anti-checks and balance administration as it is heartbreaking and a waste of my time. You know who these people are. Let's save it for when it's important. He just put on another show meeting again, the nukes again. And what came of it? Absolutely nothing. So we'll go back to why I played the Chinese and the Edith Piaf. Because if I walk the streets of San Francisco, I feel all of that. I can feel any of it. I can feel Dean Martin, and then I can feel Edith Piaf. I turn the corner, and suddenly I'm in Chinatown. I'm picking my teeth with a toothpick and wearing an undershirt and eating a $3 meal, so to speak. No one knows me. That's the way I want it. I'm having the power lunch for $3 with nobody. No one knows me. I love it. I don't need the champagne Cristal. I don't need it. I don't want it. I said to myself the other day, I woke up and I said, I could go to the Bolshoi Ballet, wherever it may be, if it's still on a private jet anytime I wanted to go. I can go see the snowfall in Vienna in the winter if I want to go to Vienna and see the snow in Vienna. Or I can go to the Himalayas, or I can go to Tibet. What am I going to go there for? What do I need it for? I look forward to finishing the radio show, walking around San Francisco, getting in my car and driving home. I don't need a chauffeur. I don't need a bodyguard. I don't need all of the entrapments that people think they need in the media. It's all nonsense. The whole concept of a bodyguard is absurd. Take a look at what just happened to the leadership of Poland if you think a bodyguard's going to protect you. I mean, come on, wake up. Oh, I love all these people in the media get you. You better be a better shot than them. Or you better be very, very lucky. Because the bodyguards aren't going to help you, let me tell you that. So you better pray a lot and be smart. And not make too much of your enemies. Don't make too much of an idiot out of your enemies. That's all I can say. Because we're living in dangerous times. So as I said, I'd rather walk around the streets and look at people and not talk to anybody. It's a much better way to live than... And traveling. I'm bringing up traveling again. I just was away for a month. At a place I have somewhere. I couldn't wait to get home. Now I can't wait to leave again to go back. That's the way it is. I guess I have an artistic nature. I didn't go to the High School of Performing Art. Or I would have amounted to nothing, like most of the people who went to the High School of Performing Art. Remember all of the artsy kids in high school who they always put on the airs, the girls wore the black tights, and the guys were like, you know, oh, they're always better than you. They were a little, you know, usually good-looking. They were very cool. Most of them amounted to nothing. It was the kid with the glasses who became the lawyer or the accountant who made something of himself. But the point they're making is no point at all. There is no point to any of the show today. None. There is no point to the show. I'm not trying to get to anything. I'm not going anywhere. We're on a journey together, but it goes nowhere. The train goes, it moves in circles, in concentric circles like a DNA. It moves like a DNA strand, down a DNA strand, the concentric circles down and down and down in a spiral and up and up and up, and then it goes down and then up again. That's what the show is going to be today. Like a strand of DNA, up in a spiral that opens, and then down in a spiral that closes, and then up and down. So now play clip five, if you don't mind.
The communique states in no uncertain terms that all of the unprecedented cooperation for which you're calling will be done on a voluntary basis, without a binding commitment. What's the likelihood that countries which have been at odds over these issues for a number of years are now going to cooperate? How can this be enforced?
Now comes the imposter. Listen to the imposter's answer.
Well, let's just take a specific example, Bill. For about 10 years, we had been encouraging Ukraine to either ship out its highly enriched uranium or transform it to a lower enriched uranium. And in part because of this conference, Ukraine took that step, announced that it would complete this step over the next couple of years. So all the commitments that we talked about are ones that we've already booked.
So in other words, he did nothing new. In other words, the Ukraine agreed already to do it before the conference, so it was a grandstander. It was nothing, a show trial, in other words. So what am I going to talk about? Everything is smoke and mirrors. Everything is a deceit. Everything is not what it appears to be. You're looking at the shadows on the wall of the cave. You're never going to actually see the actors. You're only going to see the puppets. So that's why I say I'd rather talk about things that have nothing to do with this. Now, here's an atheist by some name who says he wants to arrest the Pope for crimes against humanity. I never saw anything like this. This is amazing to me. Listen to clip 18.
Well, there's a very famous human rights counsel in London called Jeff Robertson, who's written a number of books.
Anyone who has a voice like that, I don't trust. Anyone with a fake Cambridge accent, even if he went to Cambridge, it's a fake accent at this point in history. Since the correct British accent today would be somewhat of a Pakistani accent. Anyone who actually speaks like that, I don't trust. Try 19.
What we have is very plain evidence, some of it with the Pope's own signature on it, as well as what you might call his fingerprints, and a very long-standing agreement.
Kiss my behind. Get this limey bum off my show, you fraud, you. You communist rat, you. What's this with attacking the Pope, you big fat pile of garbage, you? Why don't you go attack Gaddafi with your big mouth, or go attack Ahmadinejad, you big phony, you. They're always attacking targets that won't hurt them. All these big mouth leftists, the Pope now, they want arrested. Go try to get Ahmadinejad arrested for crimes against humanity. Or the Premier of China, go ahead. You don't hear about that. Where's your big mouth when it comes to that, you fat pile of I can't take it. That's why I don't want to do politics. See, I'm doing it while I'm saying them. So why do you travel, is the point. After saying I wouldn't, I did, but I didn't. I said I didn't, but I would. Worked it in, then worked it out. And that's all. I work with the best team in talk radio. They know me. They're like my friends. All the guys in the back room. It's unbelievable to me. This is a family. This is a team. We are the Yankees of talk radio. Well, let me take a move in another direction just for 1 minute while you're calling on these incendiary topics. And they are incendiary. Make no mistake about it. I didn't make any of them up. They're real. Now, it could be the way I'm looking at them is incendiary because the way you're used to looking at them is twisted. See, everything you look at is through the looking glass. It's upside down like Alice in Wonderland. Everything you see is backwards. I'm one of the few people left in the world who could actually see things forwards. I come from another time and another age. I have a great education. And so, therefore, I see things as they are. Your mind is warped. Your optic chiasma is backwards. Everything to you is upside down. So old Uncle Mike here is going to straighten you out every day here on the local station. Let me give you some reality, give you a reality lesson. Today, before the show, I went aboard an old sailing vessel, a gorgeous all-wood 1927 wooden ketch. It's the first motor sailor ever built. So you figure the plans were made in 1925. It was built in 27, just before the Wall Street crash. The boat is in the shape of a ship model. There is not a the captain is a really nice guy. I got to know him over the last few weeks down in the yacht harbor. And he finally gave me, he says, okay, come aboard. Yeah, I said, what kind of engine do you have? He says, well, I have a 1947 Detroit diesel. I said, unbelievable. I said, can I see it? He says, come aboard. So you have to squeeze into the engine room through a hatch. He said to me, before you go down below, he said, it's not like any engine room you've ever seen. I go below. I look at the engine. It's like an engine you could eat off. There's not a drop of oil. And the captain says to me, the owner doesn't want so much as a drop of oil on it. So it's kept perfectly, right? And he shows me a berth, a single berth, along one of the hull walls. And he smilingly said, that's where the original captain slept. I said, are you kidding me? He said, no, those were the quarters for the original captain of this vessel. I said, well, 1927. I said, that's what captains did. They slept next to the engine. I said, can you imagine what people are used to and what they demand today in order to have a job, as opposed to what people were willing to accept when they needed a job, when the government didn't provide them with everything, they had to take any job they could get. But remember, a captain of a ship then and now is a very skilled position. But even a skilled captain had to sleep down below with the engine. He didn't sleep anywhere else. And it was a different age. This was before outcome-based captaining. This was before pilots were told they could take Prozac, and if they crashed a plane, so what? I guess they're victims along with the people who they crashed the plane with. This is before universities were turned into basically nurseries for grown-up drug addicts, where the children go to fornicate and get high, and they're all given a passing degree, and then they come out, and they can't get a job, and they scream, jobs, not this, jobs, not that. They think that you owe them a job to run the company. The first day out, they can't read, they can't add, they can't write, but they want to be the CEO of the company, and they know that the owner of the company is a pig. The man they went to the job for is already the pig. They would not sell a hot dog. If you gave them a hot dog stand in Manhattan and said you have to show up every day at 4 a.m. and get the stand and put the hot dogs in and turn the water on and get the mustard and make sure it's not tomaine and make sure that the sauerkraut is heated and push it down 10 blocks like some immigrants do, they would cry and crawl up in a ball and cry and call their college advisor to find out why they have to work so hard in such an evil fascist society. And so there's the America. There's one little fingernail of America, one little snapshot of what's happened from the captain sleeping on a berth in the engine room to college graduates who can't read or write. All they know is that America is a racist nation. That's a result of 30 years of communist socialist propaganda.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from the month of April. You know, you gotta understand something. Keep playing. It's a delicate thing. Talk radio is like lovemaking in a way. I realize this is, it's not edgy. The trick to lovemaking is to make love without the other party knowing you're doing so. I mean, that's the absolute truth about talk radio. I mean, I'm already into the show, and I'm saying to you, I'm just getting ready to be into the, you know what I'm saying? Like, okay, you got the picture. I'm in a delightful mood. It must be the beans. I didn't know that they had that kind of effect on a person. The one thing I said is, are you sure that these are not, what kind of beans are they? Give me some Italian name, I never heard of them. I said they're not fava beans. No, because I'm allergic to fava beans. Many people don't know that, but it causes a internal bleeding in certain susceptible individuals. You don't know about this. Genetic, I wrote it in my book in 1983, The Skeptical Nutritionist, long out of print, years ahead of its time, 30 years ahead of its time. But you got to look into fava beans are not for everybody. But they weren't fava beans. These are different kind of beans. We have any more French music? We're allowed to enjoy the French again. They're now our allies. Now that, not the, isn't there something? But there's another French sound, cafe sound that I like. That I'm trying to get the gist of it. I can't put my finger on it. All I'm thinking about is where I'm going to have dinner tonight. You know, my family had a lot of trouble with me for many, many decades. I was the kind of guy who would eat lunch, walk out of a restaurant on vacation, immediately look in the windows of restaurants down the street and try to decide where I was going to eat dinner. They said, how could you do that? That's impossible. I said, it's a cultural thing. I'm a Mediterranean personality. The minute we finish breakfast, we're thinking about where we're going to have lunch. The minute we have lunch, we think about where we're going to have dinner. I'm not a good guy to go on vacation with in the sense that that's what I do. I take a nap every afternoon no matter where I am on earth because without it I would have been gone a long time ago. Let me tell you something about naps, the healing power of naps. Totally misunderstood and not understood at all. You want to throw away the Prozac? You want to throw away the Ritalin? You want to throw away your anxiety? Take an afternoon nap. But there's a trick to that as well that only people who know how to nap can tell you about. Because if you sleep too long, you wake up groggy and you're shot for the day. If you don't sleep long enough during the nap, it's worthless. It makes you even more jittery. So here's a trick I learned. I learned this, I don't know where. Have you heard this one before on how long to sleep and how to know how long you've slept? Well, here's old Mark Twain Savage giving you the tip of a lifetime. Well, here's how to take a proper nap in the afternoon. You see, what you do is you lie down as though you're going to sleep for the night. I mean, you can't lay down in your clothing. The trick is you got to put on your night. Well, however you sleep at night, you make believe you're going to sleep for the night. That means your pillow. That means however you sleep, naked or in pajamas, whatever you do. You close all the light. The trick is to knock out all of the afferents coming into your head. You're resting your brain now. Remember what you're doing. You lay down and you hold a set of keys in your hand. You know what I mean? You have like a big set of keys that jingle around. You hold them in your hand and you just go to sleep with that hand hanging off the side of the bed. And what you do is you go to sleep. Well, the minute you hear the keys hit the floor, they should wake you up. I take it back, though. You probably have a shag carpet, and this won't work.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
I read today bacteria has been found that thrives on arsenic, which upsets all of the knowledge of biochemistry and life on Earth. It means that there could be life on far, on distant planets. A bacteria that thrives on a toxic poison arsenic is amazing. It gives new meaning to the Van Bulow case for sure. But I ask you, what is the antidote to arsenic poisoning? Do any of you know? I do. Anyone who can figure out quickly and tell us what the antidote is to arsenic poisoning will get a free copy of TUP. Arsenic, we've all heard about it. We don't know what it is. We know it's a poison. In fact, it was used last weekend in a TV series where a man was poisoned with arsenic. Arsenic, element number 33, has a long and nefarious history. It's known to be a poison in the 15th and 16th centuries. The famous, wealthy, powerful Italian family of Borgia, I almost said Pelosi, used arsenic as their favorite poison for political assassinations. It's even been suggested that Napoleon was poisoned by arsenic-tainted wine served to him while in exile. It sounds like the house wine in San Francisco. But the fact of the matter is, arsenic is a very toxic poison. And some people know what we're talking about. We know it's a heavy metal, and it shares many toxic characteristics with other heavy metals such as lead and mercury. But what you should know is arsenic is actually found in most places in the environment. It is very abundant in the Earth's crust. It is the 20th most abundant metal in the Earth's crust. It's the 14th most abundant in seawater. And believe it or not, you have arsenic in your own body. It's the 12th most abundant in the human body. And so, therefore, you can't rush to judgment. Oh, well, we don't want any arsenic in our body because there are some actual values to arsenic. You may not know that it's used as a green pigment and that it's also used as a pesticide. And, of course, it's used to kill people. And whether you know it or not, did you remember when you used to treat wood with a green kind of chemical? I had a wooden boat many years ago. Tarangi was its name. 1969, I had a wooden sailboat, 22 feet long. A 22-foot oak-clad sailboat. And every time we hauled it out in the Alawai Yacht Harbor, which was once a year or so, you had to, you know, do the bottom over again. And the bottom paint was a green kind of paint. And it was used to treat architectural and other woods and to keep them resistant to pests, chromated copper arsenate. It was a fabulous product, but the EPA banned it in 2003 because it worked. And the reason they banned it is because it worked. You can't have a product that works. And many of you who know wood know that wood is subject to pesticide infestation. And that's why the EPA is in existence, to make sure that all of your wooden products degenerate rapidly in order to help the environment. Anyhow, you are probably getting some arsenic in your shellfish and seafood, as you are getting lead and mercury, whether you know it or not. It's also been found to contaminate rice. Well, anyway, I don't want to go on and on about it. Many of you are probably bored already. You'd rather me talk about Wrangell or TARP or the fact that the government bailed out General Electric and MSNBC. Now, the reason I jumped to this is because since I was talking about microbes that feed on arsenic, I immediately thought of the hosts of NBC and MSNBC and how they had to be supported by the taxpayer. Of course, I'm not shocked by this to find out that the government bailed out General Electric, which, of course, owns the bacteria who perform on MSNBC. But we can go to your questions. When I asked you what is the antidote to arsenic poisoning, I immediately got an answer. And it came right out of New York from WOR. Lewis, you're on the Savage Nation. Answer, please.
The answer is selenium, Michael.
Bingo! Now, the reason you knew this right away is you're a doctor?
No, actually, I'm a lawyer. But,
a lawyer?
Yeah,
you're a lawyer, and you know chemistry. What kind of law do you practice?
Actually, estate planning. So I deal with.
So that's why you're familiar with arsenic, because you know the Van Bulo case.
Well, Michael, I learned it in high school. I actually went to a very good private Catholic high school in Staten Island, and we learned that in.
That's amazing. What's interesting though is that selenium unto itself can be a toxic poison. You know that as well.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's amazing that you have this knowledge because you went to a really fine high school. It's amazing what was taught in high schools. I don't know how many years ago you went. What was it, 10, 20?
Not very long ago, Michael, not very long.
So the Catholic schools are still putting out good education. It's good to hear.
Well, you know, you get lucky every now and then. Some of us like to actually read instead of watching the garbage on television, so.
Well, you're getting a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty. You fell right into my spider web. You're getting a free copy because you like to read. I was reading that frequently that patients who are exposed to arsenic poisoning have a garlic smell to their breath. And all along, I thought that Mrs. S. was cooking with garlic. God, we better put her on the stand. All along, I thought it was garlic that I was eating. How did I know? Anyway, all kidding aside, we went on to the antidote to arsenic poisoning, which is selenium. I want to tell you an interesting selenium story because many people are very heavily into nutritional supplements, and they take too much selenium. Back when I was a new graduate in nutrition, back in 1978, I got my PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. Still a great institution in some departments, by the way, despite all the jokes. And so I remember reading, I was writing a book called The Skeptical Nutritionist. I think it came out in 1981 by Macmillan Publishing, okay? And I reported what I found in the literature. You know the great traveler named Marco Polo? That generally rings a bell with virtually any educated person. Marco Polo, you sure have all heard about him, right? There was a journal entry that said, at Aenos, the horse's hooves fell off. Where's Aenos? It's in Greece. What does it mean, at Aenos, the horse's hooves fell off? Well, some smart researchers went back in the latter part of the last century, and they went to Aenos in Greece. They pulled out the soil, and they did a soil analysis, and they found out that soil in Aenos, Greece, was particularly laden with selenium. And what happened there was, when the horses grazed on the grass in Aenos, Greece, their hooves fell off. Now, what does it have to do with you? 1978, I graduate, and I go, and I'm a clinical nutritionist in a small setting here in Sausalito. And I had a client at the time whose fingernails and hair was falling out. He was a young man. He was 28. He didn't know what was wrong. His hair was falling out. His nails were falling out. So being a pioneer in the field of nutrition, the real nutrition, I started to ask him what vitamins he was taking, what minerals he was taking. And one of the minerals he was taking was selenium. Selenium is so incredibly toxic that it has to be taken in micrograms. And he was taking almost toxic levels of selenium. I warned him. I said, drop all selenium intake. Well, sure enough, in a few months, his nails grew back and his hair came back. Now, I'm not telling you that if you how to grow your hair and nails back. However, there are certain things you can do with virtually every part of your body that are related to nutritional deficiencies and nutritional excesses. And I really don't want to go into nutrition. It's more of a statement about the antidote to arsenic, selenium, being as toxic as arsenic when it's taken in too high a dose. You know, which is true about medicines in general. The difference between a poison and a medicine is usually a matter of dosage. I don't know if you understand that. Dosage is everything. And it's an interesting political statement unto itself, if you're following me. I don't know, maybe, I don't know if the average person wants to even hear it. We're so mind-dead from what we listen to in this country, the entertainment. Sometimes I get worried if I get too technical that you want to turn the show off because you want me to deal in stereotypes or in cartoon-like images. But let me pursue it. Let's assume you are interested in what I'm saying for the minute. I don't know what people really want to hear. You don't know in radio. At a certain point, you have to go with what you're interested in. And you assume that if the host is interested and he's bubbly enough with what he's interested in, my interest will percolate through the airwaves to your ears and you'll be interested as well. There's really no reason I have to talk about Charlie Rangel or Barack Obama or the gingerbread house put up in the White House for right now, maybe a little later. You know, I don't have to say socialist or communist every 13 seconds to keep your attention. Savage. Now, I want to ask you something else. The Bible is a very complicated book. It's not just about resisting temptation. There are a lot of prohibitions in the Bible, particularly for religious Jews who can't eat certain foods, certain kosher foods you can eat, non-kosher food you can't eat, certain animals you can eat, certain animals you can't eat. It's extremely complicated. I don't know if you people know it. The average person, if they're at all religious, tries to follow the Ten Commandments, which unto itself is very hard when you consider what's in there. The Orthodox Jew has to follow 313 commandments or 330-some-odd commandments. Who can do all of that? Who can remember all of that? And so you look at the religion of Islam, and the Muslim has many of the same prohibitions as the Orthodox Jew does. So I'll make it simple. For example, the Orthodox Jew won't eat pork or pig, and the Muslim won't eat pork or pig. Why? Because if you look at Leviticus 11, there's a whole list of foods you can, animals you can eat and animals you can't eat. I can't read every one of them, but it runs for two pages. Can you believe it? These are the living things which you may eat among all the beasts that are on the earth. Whatsoever parteth the hoof, and is wholly cloven-footed, and cheweth the cud, you can eat. Nevertheless, these you should not eat, of them that only chew the cud, or of them that only part the hoof. The camel you can't eat, because he cheweth the cud, and but parteth not the hoof. He is unclean unto you. Now, why would the Bible, why would the ancient Israelites be told not to eat the camel? Well, would you eat your Chevy Tahoe? It was transportation. I mean, you could argue that the rules were written some ways to avoid eating your transportation, if you wanted to be sarcastic. But it gets more complicated, because the next one says, and the rock badger you can't eat, because he cheweth the cud, but parteth not the hoof. He is unclean unto you. So what's the prohibition on a rock badger? What do they care about a rock badger to keep it alive? Then it says you can't even eat a rabbit. Why couldn't the ancient Jew eat the rabbit? It says, and the hare, because she cheweth the cud, but parteth not the hoof. She is unclean unto you. Well, the Italians eat the hare. And the swine, because he parteth the hoof and is cloven-footed, but cheweth not the cud, he is unclean to you. Of their flesh you should not eat, and their carcasses you should not touch. They are unclean unto you. Then what about in the fish in the water? Jews can't eat shrimp. Jews can't eat, you wouldn't know that, of course, going to a smorgasbord in Florida. Jews can't eat shrimp or lobster. Go tell them that down in Boca Raton. These may eat all that are in the waters whatsoever has fins and scales in the seas and in the rivers you can eat. that all have not fins and scales in the season and the rivers and all the swarm in the waters and of all the living creatures that are in the waters, they are a detestable thing unto you. And they shall be a detestable thing unto you, shall not eat of their flesh, and their carcasses you shall have in detestation. Whatever has no fins nor scales in the waters, that is a detestable thing unto you. Right? And what about in the air? And these you shall have in detestation among the fowls. They shall not be eaten. They are a detestable thing. The great vulture, so you can't eat vulture. The bearded vulture. The osprey, the kite, the falcon, the raven, the ostrich, the nighthawk, the seamew, the hawk, the little owl, and the cormorant, and the great owl, and the horned owl, and the pelican, and the carrion vulture, and the stork, and the heron, and the hoopoe, and the bat. You can't eat them. I don't know why. What about creatures that crawl on the ground? All winged swarming things that go upon all fours are a detestable thing unto you. And he lists the ones, or they list the ones you can eat. But listen to what you can eat. You don't even know this. Attention, Orthodox Jews. Even these of them you may eat, the locust after its kinds, and the bald locust, and the cricket, and the grasshopper. So you're allowed to actually have a grasshopper stew if you're a Jewish person. Or if you really want to go into the Bible, you can have a little locust dessert, a little locust ice cream. Why? Well, it's very interesting because when I studied nutrition, I found out that not only were these great famine foods, grasshoppers are very high in protein, incidentally. The poor Africans, after living in drought, sometimes they have nothing to eat but the locust and the grasshopper, and it keeps them alive. It's a very high source of protein. But all winged swarming things which have 4 feet are a detestable thing unto you. And they go in to the whole deal. You can't eat carrion. You right? And whatsoever goes on its paws among all beasts that go on all fours, that they are unclean unto you. Whoso touch their carcass shall be unclean unto them. And he that beareth the carcass of them shall wash his clothes. Blah, blah, blah. So you go on to the whole thing. I'm not going to read all of it. It's very interesting stuff. It's long. It's long stuff. And then it gets down to the swarming thing. You can't eat them. You cannot eat liberals because it says, whatsoever goeth upon the belly, and whatsoever goeth upon all fours, and whatsoever hath many feet, even all swarming things that swarm upon the earth, them ye shall not eat. So you can't eat any liberals, I'm sorry, for they are a detestable thing. You should not make yourself... You shall not make yourself detestable with any swarming thing that swarmeth, neither shall you make. So you see what I'm getting at? It's very complicated. This is the law of the beast and of the fowl and of every living creature that moveth in the waters and of every creature that swarmeth upon the earth to make a difference between the unclean and the clean and between the living thing that may be eaten and the living thing that may not be eaten. Let's close the book and now let's use common sense. Because I've talked about this with people for years. So you say, well, you could understand why the ancients wouldn't eat pig because they saw they were a dirty animal. The pig rolled in mud. The pig ate fecal matter. And they said it's ugly, disgusting, blah, blah, blah. So they didn't eat the pig. Then there was no refrigeration. There was no preservation. And they probably saw that some people who ate pig, the heathens, would get sick and die of trichinosis. So they said, don't eat the pig. All right, so you understand that one. That's commonsensical. But what about all the other animals? What sense does it make not to eat all of these other animals, whether it be a snake when you're starving to death, which, by the way, you can eat snake meat and live quite well on it? Why would that be in there? Who would have written that? Is that the word of God? Or is that the word of man? And so if it's only the word of man, then you what? The whole Bible is only the word of man? The ancient Israelites, you could argue, were simply trying to hoodwink the dummies in order to keep them under control because they were a proud people and a stiff-necked people and didn't listen to anybody. So he said, hey, man, I saw a bush burn over there, and God came down, and he's going to punish you unless... And so he waved a rattle, and he scared everybody, and that's how the whole thing started. You could look at it that way if you want. I mean, you could say it's all shamanism. I'm not going to tell you what to think. I'm not here to convert you or sell you or tell you you're great or not great. To me, religion is just exactly that. It's what you believe in. It's your business, not mine. But take a look at what's going on the earth right now with radical Muslims who don't see the world that way. These fanatics would burn down every library on earth because they would take us back to the 8th century when they burnt the Alexandria Library when they invaded Egypt. And they burnt all the books in the Alexandria Library because to them, there was only one book on earth and that was the Quran. So they wiped out all of the learning that had been advanced in Egypt. These are the dangerous winds that we are facing on the earth today. Some of us know it, Some of us don't know it. Educated Muslims know it better than you know it. You understand what I'm saying to you? Don't assume they don't know what threats there are. The king of Saudi Arabia knows it. He knows very well he is threatened by these fanatics who would burn his kingdom to the ground if they could, which is why the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, right now, the leaders are shaking in their tents, praying to God that Israel does the work that they should be doing against Iran. So look, I've gone around and around here with the God talk. I don't even know if you want to hear any of this. And if you want to talk about it a little bit, we can do that. So let's go to you to call it. Tim in Houston, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, what's on your mind?
Hey, Mike, how are you doing today?
Good.
Just wanted to say that I am an agnostic, but I actually believe there is a God. But if I ever, you know, death comes to me and I found out that, you know, God actually wasn't a real thing, I guess I wouldn't be completely unhinged like a lot of people. My main problem is to believe in organized religion. You have to believe that every other religion is wrong. And anybody that doesn't believe, you know, say you're a Christian, then you have to believe that every Muslim's going to hell. And it's just a very unsettling thought to think that just anybody that doesn't agree with you exactly deserves to burn the rest of their lives, and it's just very unsettling to me.
So what is an agnostic as opposed to an atheist? An atheist doesn't believe in God. An agnostic hedges his bet.
I think that organized religion has basically just been hijacked by man.
Well, I've met people who are very big believers in God and the hereafter, but they don't believe in organized religion.